It's time for Security Now, a security roundup today. All sorts of stuff to talk about. The latest on Spectre. Steve hears from a programmer who's hurt by his thoughts. He will apologize. And why net neutrality may actually find a savior in the state legislatures. It's all coming up next on Security Now.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
Bandwidth for Security Now is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com. This is Security Now with Steve Gibson, episode 648, recorded Tuesday, January 30th, 2018. Post-Spectre? Security Now is brought to you by WordPress. Make WordPress.com your online home. Plans start at just $4 a month. Go to WordPress.com/securitynow and you'll get 15% off your brand new website today. And by IT Pro TV, the fun and entertaining way to sharpen your IT skills. Visit itpro.tv/securitynow and use the code SN30 to get a free 7-day trial and 30% off a monthly membership for the lifetime of your active subscription. It's time for Security Now, the show where we get together with this guy right here, Steve Gibson, and talk about security and privacy online and bugs and all sorts of stuff. It's the geekiest show we do, thanks to the geekiest guy I know. Hi, Steve.
Hey, Leo. Great to be with you again for episode 648.
Wow.
As we wrap up January and head into February.
Wow.
In 2 days. We're still trying to get the whole Spectre and Meltdown thing behind us, and I'm really wishing that it wasn't two different words. I wish there was like a nice combined name for this, just because it's sort of awkward to keep saying Spectre and Meltdown. But it's really Spectre, which has turned out to pose the biggest problem. Although Meltdown poses the greatest performance hit, it's easier to fix. So I titled this week's podcast Post Spectre, sort of in the hopeful
question mark
hopeful yes sense that maybe finally, but no. Additional news about Spectre that we have to talk about, but some other interesting stuff too. No really massively dominant story, although a bunch of interesting stuff for us to talk about, among them how not to treat Tavis Ormondy when he's trying to help you.
Ooh, don't mess with the Tav.
Don't mess. You know, he'll just go take a shower and and you'll regret it. A popular dating app where you'd really hope for HTTPS encryption, but be surprised to find it missing. Mm. The unintended consequences, and I'm sure you're up to speed on this story, of global posting of fitness tracking data.
Yes.
And how that can bite you. Gearing up or not for this year's voting machine hackfest during the August's upcoming DEF CON. It's turning out to be a bit of a problem this year. We have another record broken by a cryptocurrency exchange heist. Mm. Bad ads and fake ads. The unclear fate, which story caught me by surprise, but sort of certainly interesting to our listeners, the unclear fate of the BSD operating systems.
What?
It's not, you know, they're not doing that well. We also have a caution about last week's discussion of the dark caracal, in this case, the cross rat Trojan, another way to skin the net neutrality cat. And in fact, just while we were setting up, another piece of news broke on what states are doing on their own about net neutrality. We also have a bit of errata, some miscellany, one of the best SpinRite testimonials we've encountered in quite some time. Historically, we've had some really fun ones. Haven't really had somebody who exercises creative writing abilities for a while, but we got one this week, and then we'll wrap up with some closing the loop feedback from our terrific listeners. So I think an interesting, fun podcast.
Easy peasy. We'll get to that in a second, but first a word from our sponsor, WordPress.com. You know, I ran a WordPress site, as I've mentioned before, for years on my own server, maintaining it and all that. And even before the modern times of security flaws, it was I spent a lot of time keeping it up to date. You always want to keep any web app up to date, any server up to date. And in fact, I liked messing with my WordPress install so much that I didn't blog all that often. Fortunately, I discovered WordPress.com, and my life has been a lot easier since. WordPress.com is all everything you love about WordPress. Same software, but they keep it up to date. They keep it patched. They keep putting new plugins. They keep the plugins patched. They keep putting in new templates. And it's a community of bloggers at WordPress.com, including people like maybe Steve Gibson and me. And that way, you get an advantage you don't get if you host your own site. You're not off, you know, in your own corner of the world. WordPress.com drives traffic to your site. There's a follow button if you want. You don't have to have it, but you can put a follow button on your site so people can follow your updates there. Commenting is a lot easier. And of course, as we've talked about before, the Akismet anti-comment spam plugin is just amazing. Does a great job of keeping spam out of your comments. I can go on and on and on. The best part, I almost don't want to get too technical in my description of it, because the best part is you don't have to know any of this stuff. It does it all for you. And if at any point you don't have to hire somebody, you just go to WordPress. In fact, you can do it right now. Go to WordPress.com, do the free trial. Actually, they have a free tier that's free forever. If you want, you can set that up and then convert it to, say, the business tier later. That's the one I use. Pick a template. Start entering content. You decide to change the template. No sweat. Press another button. New look. Same content, though. Content's separate. That's one of the beauties of WordPress.com. And if you do have any questions, for instance, I said, I want a template that does this, this, and this. I thought, well, I could do some research, but why not just talk to the people at WordPress? Their WordPress support experts know everything there is to know about the platform inside and out, even more than I do. And I ran my own for a long time. And they're there 24 hours a day, 5 days a week, Monday through Friday, and almost all the day on Saturday and Sunday. So it's easy to get answers to your questions. They're fast. They said, I told them what I wanted. They said, oh, you want the 2017 template. It's very nice. And I do, and that's what I use at leolaporte.com. Plans start, as I said, there's a free tier, but even the paid tier starts at $4 a month. That's less than anybody else, and you get so much more, including search engine optimization. You get automatic social sharing, so your customers or users or readers can actually easily help spread the word about your business on their Twitter or Facebook feed. That's gold. That is gold. Come see why 29% of the entire internet runs at WordPress. WordPress.com/security now. That way they'll know you heard it here, and you, as a thank you, will get 15% off that new website. WordPress.com/security now. Create that website, find the plan that's right for you, and get 15% off. WordPress.com/security now. I didn't put words in your mouth. You're still using it, right?
Yeah, I absolutely am. Yeah. Yes.
Why wouldn't you? It's kind of easy.
My blogs are. Yeah. Just it sucks. Like, you don't want to spend that much time on that. You just want to get your thoughts out.
Exactly. You want to put out the content. I mean, you and this is a guy who runs his own servers for everything else. And, you know, it's a lot of work to keep a server up and running.
Yeah.
It's a full-time job.
So, we've been having a lot of fun in recent weeks with our pictures of the week.
Yes.
And on this occasion, there were just too many. We will have an overage of pictures of the week for at least several weeks while we catch up. So it was difficult to choose which one. One of the things that has happened is that the Meltdown and Spectre vulnerabilities have prompted the creation of a number of interesting twists on the Intel Inside logo. And of course, so we have Meltdown Inside and Spectre Inside for this week's picture. Next week, unless it's preempted by something even better, we have another take on the older Intel Inside logo. And I almost used that for this week, but I thought, well, who knows what's going to be in store for next week.
I don't even remember the older Intel Inside.
You will when you see when you see next week's picture of the week. It brings back some fond memories. But anyway, so just some more fun about Intel and their logos. A couple things have happened on that front, on the Spectre Meltdown front. Actually, Meltdown, as I mentioned at the top of the show, that got resolved quickly, although at some performance cost. It was the most expensive in performance for older machines that didn't support that PCID and invalidate PCID features, which were added, and as we corrected the record on, it was Haswell and subsequent have the invalidate PCID instruction, which works with the PCID feature that was introduced earlier but never used. So as long as you have that, you were able to mitigate the meltdown problem without much performance hit. Earlier machines did take a hit, but that pretty much resolved things. What happened, though, as we have been discussing the last couple of weeks, is that Intel stumbled in there, and you know, no doubt there was under tremendous pressure in a great hurry. Although, as we understood the coverage, there were months going by in the late summer where they knew there was a problem, yet that hadn't come out onto the surface. Maybe they weren't ready to release yet, or maybe they were testing, who knows. But as a consequence of that, as we were discussing last week, they made mistakes in the release of the firmware, which affected apparently a large subset of their processors, maybe all of them. Unfortunately, the disclosure was sort of deliberately murky, and you know, it was squeezed out through the PR funnel that left us with more questions than it did answers. Since then, Microsoft has formalized their withdrawal of the support for that firmware. In other words, last week I was talking about, okay, well, if you're not having any problems, then just probably holding your breath is good enough. The Spectre liability, the Spectre vulnerability is protected. It's mitigated. And if your system is not having what Intel, you know, sort of obtusely says more frequent reboots than usual, whatever that means, then leave well enough alone. If you are having a problem, you, as we discussed last week, you could back out to an earlier version of the firmware offered in an earlier version of the BIOS from your manufacturer, which would probably be around since you would have just been able to update recently. And of course, Intel, we discussed last week, formally said to all their partners, don't give anybody else this firmware. We're working on, like, we now understand what's wrong with the firmware in a couple cases. We're working on fixing all of this. Well, Microsoft since has gone a step further. They have issued a Windows update to disable the mitigation against the Spectre variant 2, which is the focus of all of this. So their update is literally titled Update to Disable Mitigation Against Spectre Variant 2. They wrote in this, Intel has reported issues with recently released microcode meant to address Spectre Variant 2. Specifically, Intel noted that this microcode can cause, quote, and here, you know, they're just quoting everybody down some chain, higher than expected reboots or other unpredictable system behavior, unquote. And then noted, says Microsoft, quoting Intel, that situations like this may result in data loss or corruption. Our own experience, Microsoft says, is that system instability can, in some circumstances, cause data loss or corruption. On January 22nd, Intel recommended that customers stop deploying the current microcode version on affected processors while they perform additional testing on the updated solution. We understand, says Microsoft, that Intel is continuing to investigate the potential effect of the current microcode version and we encourage customers to review their guidance on an ongoing basis to inform their decisions. While Intel tests, updates, and deploys new microcode, we are making available an out-of-band update today. And this is their KB4078130 that specifically disables only the mitigation against, and then we have the CVE number. I've got these things memorized. I didn't ever think I was going to be memorizing CVEs, but this, you know, there's three of them. This is the variant 2 of Spectre ending in 5715. That's the bugaboo in all of this. And that's the branch target injection vulnerability. Microsoft says in our testing, this update, that is this one they just released a couple days ago, out of band, this update has been found to prevent the described behavior, meaning the higher than expected reboots, which is a good thing. For the full list of affected devices, see Intel's microcode revision guidance. This update, Microsoft says, that is their just released out of band, yet another update, covers Windows 7 Service Pack 1. That is the most recent service pack of Windows 7, the only one it'll ever get. Windows 8.1 and all versions of Windows 10 for client and server. If you are running an affected device, this update can be applied by downloading it. This is not going to be pushed to you. So this is the reason I'm bringing this all up, is that our listeners have to go get it if they want it. Can be applied by downloading it from the Microsoft Update Catalog website. Application of this payload specifically disables only the mitigation against and then the CVE ending in 5715. That is the branch target injection vulnerability. I have a link to it in the show notes. I'm sure, Leo, that if the search for it will find it. Now, what's interesting is Microsoft also goes on in this guidance to describe registry changes, which will also do the same thing. And that is exactly what GRC's Inspector utility does.
We should mention, you probably shouldn't install this unless you're experiencing these issues, though, right? Or do you recommend people roll back even if you're not getting reboots?
Okay, so, I mean, this is why this is all somewhat controversial. That is, it isn't just cut and dry, black and white. There is still no known exploitation of any of this in the wild. Even the meltdown that was the easy one to do, that is the easiest one to exploit. So these all remain theoretical vulnerabilities for which there is no reason to believe anyone is like actively in danger from. So the biggest danger apparently is from turning on this feature with both the faulty Intel microcode and Microsoft's enabling this feature, which causes some system instability. That's the biggest problem that has ever been seen from all of this, is the mitigation of this problem. So, my Twitter feed has been full of feedback from people. There, I've seen some reports of people believing their system became less stable, who then disabled or backed out, and things seemed to be better. But it's all kind of like no one has been able to like firmly find a test for the problem or invoke the instability and conclusively demonstrate that, oh, now it's gone again. So I think my advice is what it was last week, although now we have another piece. Last week was back yourself out of the microcode if it's causing a problem. Now, since then, Microsoft has said, we'll back you out by by like giving you a link you can click to give you another go get it if you want it update, which does the same thing as just turning it off. That is, even if it's in your microcode, if you turn it off, the instability goes away. Now, that's news. I couldn't assert that last week because I always, as we know, I built that in to Inspector from the beginning. There's cute little buttons down there at the bottom of the Inspector app, which you can just press and it'll turn off the Spectre or the Meltdown. You got a button for each mitigation. So now Microsoft has confirmed that turning it off prevents the instability. So you could either download Microsoft's thing that turns it off, and then I'm not sure how you turn it back on again, which is one problem. I mean, I guess maybe
presumably there's another update coming from Microsoft at some point that would fix it.
Where it's like, okay, everything's finally good.
Never.
Yeah, exactly. Whenever never. That happens. Yeah. So you could use Inspector to flip it off, and then you could flip it back on again. But arguably, you would be waiting in any event for newer microcode, which doesn't have this more frequent rebooting side effect. And then Microsoft, once everyone's sure we got it this time, Microsoft will, you know, send us another update out of band or in band or some, you know, who knows what the band will be playing at that point. And then we can all move forward. Also, Inspector got a revision because we found a bug in the creators update, not the fall creators update. That is that the fall creators update is 1709 of Windows 10. It turns out that 1703 had a bug. There's the 32-bit support in Windows turns out to be completely different than the 64-bit support. Back once upon a time, the Windows API was 16 bits. And then, of course, they went to 32. Those were very similar. That is, you could load 32-bit code into a 16-bit process and call it. But you can't do that with 32 and 64. They are completely different. Well, it turns out that Inspector, my code, is a 32-bit app. And the 32-bit app, as all 32-bit apps do, calls the 32-bit API. Well, there's a function in Windows, a DLL, ntdll.dll, which exists in both 32 and 64-bit flavors. And we discovered, actually it was a researcher in the GRC newsgroups discovered that because users were reporting that of 32-bit – no, users were reporting who were using the creators update, 1703, that Inspector was saying they were not protected. But the 64-bit version was saying they were protected. Well, it turns out that there's a bug in Windows 32-bit implementation of NTDLL in the creators update, which they fixed in the fall creators update, but it persists in the creators update. So I had to scramble around, and I wrote my first 64-bit assembly code last week. I created a 64-bit probe, which is contained within the 32-bit inspector, so that if it sees it's on a 64-bit system, it launches this 64-bit probe into the system, which is the only way for it to get a view of reality in light of this buggy implementation of ntdll.dll in the creators update. So we're at release 6. And Leo, while I was there, I also implemented the fix that we talked about last week, which is inverting the sense of yes and no and in the presentation.
Nice. So I'll download it right now.
If you get a green yes, that's good, instead of getting a green no, which was confusing. So now if you get yes, that's the good news, and the no's with an exclamation point are red. So that's been fixed also. And we're at about 355,000 downloads.
Wow.
So
we're trucking along
and doing well and continue to get good, you know, attention and coverage. And it's helping people. So now we know that if you feel that your system is unstable, you don't have to back out of your microcode. You don't have to update and go out and get the out of band up patch unless you want to. And in fact, it may be that thing only sets the registry. I don't know what it does, but because Microsoft also said, or you can do this to the registry, which Inspector does for you and safely and reversibly. So lots of options for our users. And, you know, it's confusing. There's no known exploitation of these vulnerabilities. The ones that are causing the biggest problem would be the hardest to exploit. So we would expect to see them maybe taking longer to happen, if they even ever do. The biggest problem, as I mentioned, is the cure is worse than the disease in this case for many people. You know, all of our systems are running more slowly for apparently no good reason at the moment. But again, better safe than sorry, I think. In this case, if you suspect that your system is misbehaving in any fashion, then turning off this Spectre mitigation until we get updated firmware from Intel certainly would make sense. And Microsoft is sort of saying, you know, corruption, data loss or corruption, meaning that's kind of more scary. At least a reboot is like, ooh, whoops, we crashed. If it's actually could cause, and I think that's what Microsoft is saying, data loss or corruption. I don't know if that's with the reboot or silently without it bothering to reboot, but that's of concern too. So, yeah, I don't know.
Yeah. I'd heard the same thing. So,
yeah. So anyway, that's an update on the gift that keeps on giving, the industry. I'm sure that Intel is working hard. They say they understand what's going on. They're not sharing it with us, which is really my only source of angst is, you know, it would be we're just sort of dealing in a vacuum, and this podcast likes to have facts to deal with. And so, like, oh, it's worse than it used to be. More reboots than usual. Yeah. What? You know, it's like, okay. Okay.
We should mention that we were talking about this on Mac Break Weekly, and I know you heard this, but Apple had wisely avoided using the Intel fix. They did the calculus that we've kind of done, which is, well, since there's nothing out in the wild, let's patch it on WebKit, on our browser, because that's the only exploitation vector that we really know about, and we'll wait until Intel gets it right. Or, I mean, it sounds like they kind of sensed there was something wrong with the Intel fix.
That Google was also very quick with their very clever retpolene solution, which is it does require code recompilation, but Apple is able to recompile their code in order to implement that fix. Okay, so Tavis, our great buddy at Google, who just, you know, everywhere he looks, it's like with this amazing fine-tuned precision ability to find find vulnerabilities and help the industry get smarter, has decided to take a look at highly popular online gaming, thinking nobody's looked over there, you know, with his level of expertise. It turns out that last December, he took a look at Blizzard's company-wide, distribution-wide download and install and maintenance facility and found a significant problem. This affected World of Warcraft, Overwatch, Diablo 3, StarCraft 2, you know, the entire catalog of extremely popular Blizzard online gaming. He reached out to them, as he does, you know, for full responsible disclosure, opened a dialogue, explained the problem that he found, provided them with a proof of concept, which allowed, get this, any website to leverage the lack of strong authentication in Blizzard's entire suite of gaming to allow it to download and install and run arbitrary code on any gamer's machine. Whoops. Unfortunately, who knows what the politics is behind this, but I don't think whoever it was he talked to at Blizzard knew who he was, because they stopped communicating with him. They went silent, cut him off, and then implemented a fix that didn't work without any further interaction. They then went public with their great, you know, ballyhooing, we care about security, we fix things, and Tavis said, no, you didn't. That's not a good fix. And the bottom line is, after a little bit of embarrassment and backpedaling, somebody more mature or more aware of what's going on in the industry said, oh, shoot. Yes, Tavis knows what he's talking about. Apologies were made. Dialogue was reestablished. Blizzard then said that what they put out was something that they had around for a while and it wasn't really meant to be the permanent fix, but they're doing one now and they'll have it online soon. And Tavis said, well, okay, good. And so they've reestablished communication with him, and with any luck, they will involve him in their proposed solution this time, and he can take a look at it and say, yes, that looks good. And this is of interest to all other major online gaming companies, because Tavis has since decided that he's going to look at the other ones. So if you're not Blizzard and you have been watching this happen, when, you know, make sure Tavis has a way of getting a hold of you, and listen when he tells you that he's found a problem. Don't be embarrassed. Don't suddenly, you know, pull the rug in over yourself and hide. Just work with him, fix the problem, and that'll be the path to least resistance. So, you know, those of us in the security industry, and we talk about this all the time, you know, have learned that certainly, for example, the guys at LastPass respond within minutes of Tavis contacting them and saying, whoops, I found the problem here, as does everybody in the security industry. So, you know, Blizzard probably now understands that that Tavis and Google and Project Zero are valuable components of this industry that should be taken advantage of when offered freely, as they are. Some researchers at a security firm in Tel Aviv named Checkmarks took a look at Tinder's iOS and Android mobile apps and were surprised to find that it lacked HTTPS encryption, if you can believe it or not. Anyone sharing the same Wi-Fi as a Tinder, an iOS or Android mobile Tinder device or Tinder app user can see your Tinder photos, add their own into the photo stream, and track what you do on Tinder. They're not using encryption to keep the photos safe from anybody who wants to eavesdrop. And although apparently they are using encryption for encrypting the actions of a Tinder user, the encryption is spotty, and it turns out that even looking at the encrypted stream, it is possible to ascertain what the user is doing. So Checkmarks produced a proof of concept app called Tinder Drift, which is demoed on YouTube, which reconstructs any Tinder user's online session of what they see and the way they respond to what they see, essentially unmasking any person's behavior who is using Tinder on shared, you know, on a shared Ethernet medium like Wi-Fi. So although, again, the swipes and matches are encrypted, Checkmarks explained and proved, hackers sharing the same Wi-Fi are able essentially to completely unmask everything that is being done. It turns out that the specific patterns of bytes that represent a left swipe, a right swipe, a super like, whatever that is, and a match are all clear. But even though technically they're encrypted, nobody at Tinder really gave the security of their application much thought, apparently, or any real concern over protecting the privacy of their users. The Verge, in their coverage, asked Tinder to respond to this. And so Tinder did respond, saying that the unencrypted photos are profile pictures, and Tinder is a free global platform, so the pictures are, quote, available to anyone swiping on the app anyway. Of course, what isn't free and global are the individual Tinder users' choices and reactions to those unencrypted, unprotected photos, which this research demonstrates was poorly concealed. So I'm glad, again, we just keep seeing example after example. I mean, we just talked about it with Tavis and Blizzard, and here now Checkmarks in Tel Aviv and Tinder, where we have to have oversight. We have to have an environment where security firms and researchers are able to examine these things. And I'm thankful that they're willing to volunteer their time and do so. You know, they bring some beneficial, positive press to themselves for doing so. And in the process, you know, it's benefiting the users of these applications, for which it's clear not enough attention has been given to security. Which is the perfect segue to Leo. For a while, I kept trying to sort of ignore this story because I thought, really, this is bad. This is a story. Finally, I was just overwhelmed by it. It was without a doubt the most tweeted news item this week. And that is the unintended consequences of globally connecting your fitness tracking devices and what happens when arguably position-sensitive personnel are tracking their fitness with them, specifically U.S. military personnel. Turns out that the Pentagon, military personnel are probably already fitness-oriented, and they're going to be using Fitbits and similar tracking devices. Turns out that the U.S. Armed Services has even taken to giving personnel these devices to encourage them and their fitness. And what came to light was that there is a firm that had been collecting all of this data and aggregating it globally and pushing it through mapping software. What it turns out you're able to do is essentially it creates a heat map of where people are all over the world who are using fitness tracking devices. And while so my first thought was, okay, well, yeah, duh. So what? But it turns out there are many places where our military would not want confirmation of their personnel. And although this, I mean, this doesn't de-anonymize these people, you can't use it to prove what is going on somewhere. Any bad guy can, you know, pinch and zoom and pan around and wonder, okay, wait a minute, what is going on here? And what is going on here? And what is going on there? So it certainly does clearly represent a leakage of information of the potential position of people, which you would not otherwise have. You know, you might presume to be maintaining radio silence where, unfortunately, your fitness tracking device knows, you know, is receiving GPS coordinates, storing it, and then uploading it somewhere where it's being aggregated. And so this sort of creates an end-around disclosure of the position of these things, which may be worn by military personnel, may be in locations where we would rather not have, or I mean anybody would rather not have any disclosure that, you know, people are running along a certain trail in a certain location in the world. And yet, now it's all public.
I wonder if you can fault Strava for releasing this data. The other question we had was, because Strava, you can turn on private so that you're not sharing, but it's not clear whether this data released, it's private because it's not any individual, but if it's in aggregate, including private information. In other words, if it would be enough for the military to set private and then go for a run, and it's still Strava has a heat map. It sounds like that's what happened. And that they released it is, to me, like, come on, guys. Nevertheless, the military has changed their procedure, and they will be strongly encouraging people not to do that anymore.
Well, and I'm sure, no doubt, that military minds are themselves pinching and zooming and looking to see what is now in the public domain. What is,
all this satellite data was already out there, right?
Right.
So they know, I think they know where the bases are. The only the one weird use case was if a base was pretending that it was closed, and then you saw people running around,
like deliberately being dark.
Yeah,
yeah.
But like, if you look at the on the Strava heat map, if you look at the Pentagon, it's actually quite interesting. We showed it yesterday on Twit.
Oh, cool!
And you could see people running around the Pentagon, but it's completely dark inside the ring. And at first I thought, well, that's nobody's getting exercise inside the ring. But really, it's not that. It's that that's radio hardened. Nothing's getting out of the ring. Of course. Right.
So no device that is in there knows where it is.
Yeah,
yep.
Of course not. Yep. And I bet you if you looked at the same thing, if you looked at the White House or any place they're trying to keep it secure, right?
Yeah. And at the same time, black zones are information,
that tells you something, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting, yeah.
Wow.
Leave it at home, kids.
Yeah. So anyway, I mean, this is the consequence of a world where everything is connected to everything else. And, you know, we're still learning how to handle the power of this kind of information.
Right.
Speaking of which, voting machine makers.
This is 2018 is 9-10 months away, right?
Yep, this is, are this telling is, Voting machine makers are trying to stifle the sales of decommissioned and resold voting machines by threatening eBay sellers with litigation if they sell these machines, telling them that it is illegal to do so, which it is absolutely not. So we all remember all the fun we had last year after last year's DEF CON, which was the largest of the voting village. DEF CON hosts this voting village competition where they collect just a completely heterogeneous assortment of voting machines and tell the hackers, okay, have at it, kids. Let's see what you can do. And last year's was the biggest by far. It had been going on quietly at DEF CON, but it sort of really got a lot of attention last year. And what we learned and had fun with on this podcast was the horrifically poor security that the machines actually had. We had fun with it. Of course, the voting machine manufacturers did not. They are not happy. And as I said, they've been actively threatening sellers of used and retired machines with legal action should their machines be resold, even though doing so is completely legal. So remember last year we talked about this. I mean, there were machines that all had – I think it was Sequoia machines – all had the same hard-coded password. All of them.
Well, that's for convenience, you see.
It's correct. You wouldn't have to write all those pesky passwords down.
Yeah.
Some lacked any security, apparently, at all. Some could be penetrated without physical contact to the device. In some cases, a USB thumb drive had to be inserted, but not all. Some just offered you the convenience of Wi-Fi. Many had software that was riddled with well-known vulnerabilities that had been documented for years, if not decades, that had never been patched or updated. Most machines had never been wiped. And in some cases, there were machines that had – there was one case – had 600,000 voter registration database still present in it that was available for exfiltration from this machine. I mean, so it was an embarrassing catastrophe for voting machine companies and voting machine security in general. Well, in preparation for this year's upcoming DEF CON, the Voting Village organizers indicated during their own talk at ShmooCon, they told attendees at the ShmooCon hacking conference that they were having a surprisingly difficult time preparing for this year's upcoming DEF CON Voting Village event because they were having a hard time acquiring machines after what happened last year. And what they learned when trying to buy machines was that the manufacturers were threatening one of the most popular sources of these machines for resale, which was eBay. eBay resellers receiving notices threatening them with legal action should they sell those machines. So for what it's worth, if we have any eBay resellers within earshot of this podcast, there is nothing illegal about reselling these machines. It is perfectly legal, as is their hacking. And I will say again, this is the only way we're going to get security. I mean, until recently, these electronic voting machines have been allowed, even from well-known companies like Diebold have been able to say, we're a security company. Trust us, these machines are secure. Turns out it's absolutely not true. Remember, there was not a single machine that withstood attack last year. Not one. Some of them collapsed within minutes. Some took maybe an hour or two. Not a single one survived attack, which is just an should be just beyond embarrassing for these companies. And so, you know, my feeling, of course, is that no machine should be allowed to be used that hasn't had full, well, first of all, they ought to be open source. They ought to be fully scrutinized. They ought to have academia looking at them, you know, saying, yes, we find no problems with these. And then that machine should be produced. So this notion of, you know, proprietary software in voting machines for something like U.S. elections, that just has to end. It is the wrong way to for this to have been done. And, you know, these chickens are coming home to roost. Leah, let's take a break. I'm going to sip some coffee, and I think we're probably about halfway through. So we will pick up on additional interesting stories afterwards.
Well, it's easy enough because our sponsor for this section of Security Now is a company that probably everybody watching knows about. Many of you are customers of. I'm talking about IT Pro TV. Every time people come in and sit in on this show more than any other, they say, oh, yeah, IT Pro TV, I use them. We went to Lisa and I went to their grand opening of their new studio complex, five new studios where they produce these IT training programs in Gainesville, Florida. It's about a year now. And everybody who was there at this grand opening, there were hundreds of people who came to it, including many customers. They all, to a man, said, say hi to Steve. Tell Steve hi. They love you. I guess if you're interested in IT, Security Now is a natural place for you to be listening. And if you're interested in Security Now, then maybe you ought to consider a career in IT. There are a lot of great jobs open, very high-paying jobs, particularly IT security. The last number I saw was 1 million open jobs in the U.S. For IT security professionals. Go study, learn, get your certs, and get that job at IT Pro TV. They have over 3,300 hours now of on-demand training in every possible category. They're making 125 hours every week. Like I said, five studios running almost all the time, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. In every possible topic, you can watch live, just as you might watch us live. There's a chat room just like ours, but it's all focused on IT stuff like, the Certified Ethical Hacker, the CEH cert, or how to use Kali Linux, the ultimate pen testing Linux, Linux security techniques, ITIL, ISC squared security certs, and a lot more. Certs in every area of IT. And even if you've already got the certs and the job, you need to, as you know, in IT, keep your skills up and broaden your skills. And there's so much to learn. This is the fun way to do it. Friendly training, binge-worthy content, and life-changing results at IT Pro TV. Watch it on your computer. Watch it on your phone. They have Android and iOS apps. You can also watch it on your big screen. It works with Chromecast. They have a Roku app, Amazon Fire TV, their Apple TV app. Put it up on the big screen. Have breakfast. Get ready. Get in the car. Go to work. Listen on your Android phone as you're driving to work. Get to work. Have it up on your computer while you're working. And just by osmosis, over time, you're going to learn and learn and learn and be able to get, you know, a better job or be better at your existing job. Check out the team solution. If you have an IT team you run, they've got a supervisor portal that's second to none. It's really easy to use, and it gives you full control over your team's training schedule. You can create custom groups. You can give training assignments. You can see individual analytics, group analytics, so you really know how your team's doing. And it's a great portal. Join the more than 85,000 IT Pro TV members today, most of them listeners to this show, and get the IT job you've always wanted. itpro.tv/securitynow. You can try it for free for 7 days when you use the offer code SN30. You will also get 30% off your subscription if you decide to sign up, as long as you stay active on that monthly membership. Premium subscriptions include unlimited Transcender practice exams and virtual labs. That's normally $857 a year, but with the offer code SN30, $600. $50 a month. That's certainly less than a technical school. This is better than a technical school because you can watch it all the time. It's enjoyable. They have great instructors. It's probably even less than just buying the practice exams or the books. itpro.tv/security now. Use the code SN30. This is the best way to get ready for a job in IT or to keep your job in IT. itpro.tv/security now. Again, the code SN30, 7 days free, 30% off the monthly subscription for the lifetime of your subscription. Friendly training, binge-worthy content, life-changing results. itpro.tv/security now. You can also get a free trial of the supervisor portal for their team solution there as well. itpro.tv/security now. Now on we go with our security training with Mr. Steve Gibson.
Yay.
Yeah.
So we have broken a record again on the largest heist in a cryptocurrency exchange. We all recall when 4 years ago, back in 2014, Mt. Gox, which at the time was one of the largest Bitcoin exchanges, ended up filing for bankruptcy after admitting that it had lost $450 million worth of Bitcoins. Well, it turns out that now, just a few days ago, CoinCheck, which is a Tokyo-based cryptocurrency exchange, has suffered what appears to be the largest hack of cryptocurrency loss in history, totaling what would be $532 million in digital assets. In a blog posting, they acknowledged or confirmed the cyber heist. However, they did not explain how the tokens were stolen, and then froze most of the assets and their services, including deposits, withdrawals, and trade, because no doubt they want to figure out what it was that happened. Interestingly, though, they did not freeze their trading of Bitcoin, which did take a 5% hit in its market valuation on this news. So anyway, I mean, I guess this is the problem with it's an acknowledged problem, even though this is a huge, you know, more than half a billion dollar loss. We're seeing people having problems maintaining the security of their cryptocurrency constantly. We have often said that it is incredibly difficult, if not arguably impossible, in a complex enough environment to have true security, and that you only have security to the degree to which nobody is trying to penetrate the barriers that you have erected to protect yourself. And so, you know, money is money, and where there's money, there's going to be pressure to penetrate security. So it looks like, I'm sure that other exchanges are taking lessons from these massive losses and doing everything they can to protect themselves. Individuals need to do the same. Those individuals who have substantial assets in cyber currency need to really, the only thing you can do, I think, is to store it offline. That's a common refrain of mine when, for example, I've talked about the QR codes that I use for registering new devices, authenticators. You know, I understand it's inconvenient to have them offline, but it's the only way to be safe. And the same is certainly true of cryptocurrency wallets. You want to keep them offline when they're not in use, because if it's online, it's vulnerable. So certainly these guys, CoinCheck, have learned that lesson, or presumably learned that lesson. I hope other exchanges have. I guess what would be foreseeable, it came to light from an advertising security company, and I didn't know there was an advertising security company, but I'm glad there is advertising security. Confiant is the name of this company that discovered the existence of a very large and malicious advertising operation, which they named Zirconium, which I thought was kind of a fun name for a fake advertising, I mean, a huge fake advertising effort. This zirconium operation created 28 completely fraudulent fake advertising agencies and established them with full-blown apparent credentials, Facebook pages, LinkedIn accounts. They created fake people to populate them and created fake personas for them, basically erecting an entire 28 separate agencies in order to funnel and mask their advertising. It was so large that Confiant determined during the peak of their activity, the group was purchasing 62% of ad monetized websites on a weekly basis. So just a large machine. Confiant believes that about 2.5 million users who encountered zirconium's malicious ads were redirected to a malicious site, with about 95% of those 2.5 million users being based in the U.S. Essentially, they purchased over 1 billion ad views last year in 2017 and used these malicious ads to redirect users to tech support scams and malicious pages peddling malware-laden software updates and software installers. Unfortunately, what was done was, and this is the technology we've talked about often, is that the ads have the ability to run JavaScript, and they used something that they described as JavaScript code executing a forced redirection to hijack visitors' browsers' queries that were trying to just display an ad on an ad that was on some website. The browser was redirected in a series of bounces first to a server that an intermediary domain that would fingerprint and classify the incoming traffic, then redirect the user to another domain operated by zirconium, where they would then be sent to a third domain, which was an affiliate traffic jumping off point, which allowed others to buy traffic which had been hijacked from legitimate sites. So essentially, this was arguably not the fault of the websites hosting the ads. You know, they thought they were hosting legitimate ads, but essentially 28 full-blown fake ad agencies were created specifically for the creation of malicious advertising. So, they were often offering fake malware-laced flash player updates, which, as we know, has been historically and is still not completely gone away, a means of getting malicious code into people's machines. So anyway, I thought this was interesting because this gives us a better sense of the scale to which malicious advertising is being deployed. And right during the same period of time, well, actually not all of 2017, but just in the last couple of weeks, YouTube was hit with CoinHive cryptocurrency mining advertising. It turns out the good news is that antivirus software is now up to speed about CoinHive. And so what set off alarms is that visitors to YouTube were having their antivirus tools firing off warnings that that cryptocurrency mining was going on. And sure enough, 80% of their processor was being used, leaving just enough unused to play videos. So essentially, while people were watching YouTube videos, the rest of their system was being commandeered for Monero cryptocurrency mining with CoinHive. Trend Micro, that of course is one of the major AV monitoring folks, providers and monitors, said that the ads drove a more than threefold spike. That is the YouTube ads, the ads appearing on YouTube, more than a threefold spike in web miner detections during this period of time. A Google representative who was asked about the incident by Ars Technica, that was one of the outlets reporting on this, told Ars Technica that mining cryptocurrency, this is Google, you know, the owners of YouTube, mining cryptocurrency through ads, is they wrote, is a relatively new form of abuse and violates our policies, and one that we've been monitoring actively. They wrote, "We enforce our policies through a multi-layered detection system across our platforms, which we update as new threats emerge. In this case," they wrote, "the ads were blocked in less than 2 hours, and the malicious actors were quickly removed from our platforms." Well, unfortunately, Ars observed that it wasn't clear what the representative meant when saying the ads were blocked in less than 2 hours. Evidence supplied by Trend Micro and on other social media where there was an outcry about that demonstrated that the ads containing substantially the same JavaScript ran for as long as a week on YouTube. And then when queried about that, the Google representative did not respond to Ars' follow-up questions looking for a timeline of when the abusive ads started and ended. So again, you know, this is a moving target. Nobody is and has found a way to be completely clear of these sorts of attacks. All you can do is respond to them as quickly as possible. And as we've talked about here, because it's necessary for users' browsers to go obtain the script from CoinHive, blocking the CoinHive domain, as we covered several weeks ago, or using some add-on such as uBlock Origin or one of the good monitors of these sorts of domain queries should keep at least your own machine from being commandeered for this. But of course, it's an industry-wide problem. CSO Magazine had an interesting piece that caught my attention, which was brought to me thanks to one of our listeners, posing the question whether the BSD versions of the open source Linuxes are dying. And apparently some researchers
believe... Wait a minute, the BSD versions of open source Linux, those are two different
things. Okay, BSD, no, like OpenBSD, FreeBSD...
Yeah, those are not
and
Linux.
NetBSD.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I meant Unix.
Thank you for catching me. You scared me.
Okay. Just purely misquote.
No, but I think it is the success of Linux that's starting to make these other versions go away. And correct. You and I both are BSD fans.
Correct. And I have been forever. But ultimately, I suspect that the open source ecosystem may not need nor be able to support more than one, one winning open source solution. And I think it's very clear that solution is going to be Linux.
In a way, that's too bad. Somebody said, I have a quote in my blog, and I'll go look and see who said that Linux is a POSIX compliant Unix designed by PC users. Let me see if I can find the quote, because it's a great quote. And BSD is, you know, designed by Unix users.
Yes.
And PCs are kind of secondary to the whole point, right?
Yes. So while you look, I'll provide a little bit of background here. So we have three of them. We have
There's many, actually. BSD,
Yeah.
Yeah.
The top are OpenBSD, FreeBSD, and NetBSD.
Yeah. There's also BSD, PCBSD, which is now TrueOS, which is a very popular version as well. So there's a lot of...
Didn't that branch from
TrueOS.
FreeBSD?
Yeah, I mean, many of them have been branches, but at this point...
Yeah.
BSD, this is Matthew D. Fuller. BSD is what you get when a bunch of Unix hackers sit down to try to port a Unix system to the PC. Linux is what you get when a bunch of PC hackers sit down and try to write a Unix system for the PC. That's the difference. It's, you know, it's more pure Unix-y, right?
Yes. Yes. And if, frankly, that's been my affection for it.
Yeah.
OpenBSD is regarded to have the highest security because security has been its primary focus from the start. And in terms of like bugs found in the kernel, it supports that. I mean, it's living up to its promise. FreeBSD is regarded as the most advanced and feature-rich, though that has come at some cost in security, because if you let your guard down, as we know, bugs are going to creep in. NetBSD is regarded as having the least secure, because its focus has been upon having the widest run on anything profile, supporting any device and any platform. And again, you know, there's going to be a security consequence of just, you know, like having like a lot more legacy driver code, so you can continue to run on really old hardware, which is not being supported and nobody is really scrutinizing very much anymore. And so the argument has been that, you know, that as a consequence of just a lack of eyeballs, and that's really what it boils down to, a lack of eyeballs looking at the kernels of these BSD operating systems, they don't have as many people looking at them. In some cases, vulnerabilities that are reported are not fixed in a timely manner where they are with Linux. And again, I'm, you know, FreeBSD has been my Unix, my non-Windows Unix OS of choice. And I wouldn't be surprised to find that if in time these alternative OSs just sort of, they just slow down and stop being developed because there just isn't enough steam behind them. And I do wonder if fundamentally there is enough interest to support more than one primary non-proprietary open source alternative. And we know what that would be. That would be Linux.
Yeah. I don't know.
Kind of probably inevitable.
Yeah, I think it is. You know, hardware support is a real issue in the PC universe. That takes a lot of people banging on it.
Yeah.
And then, you know, frankly, the presentation layer on BSDs are just, it's not as elegant looking.
Nope.
Yeah. And so, you know, that's somewhat related to hardware support, I guess. But anyway.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And the other thing is that, you know, a lot of them are beginning, and we're seeing this, they're beginning to cross borrow, you know, chunks of technology because they can't afford to just redevelop the same thing independently.
Right.
So it's like, oh, well, yes, we, you know, we borrowed this from that. We like the network stack from this OS and the you know, we're compatible with these graphics drivers because, you know, they just can't afford to have them all rewritten from scratch.
Yep.
Yeah, but again, I just thought that was an interesting little tidbit, is that what we're seeing is we're seeing them, you know, some of the fervor dying off. Also, you really have to be a serious hardcore developer to be mucking around in the kernel of one of these operating systems and not create more trouble than, you know, like more problems than you solve. So you can have the best of intentions, but it's a little bit like how, you know, the U.S. space shuttle system began having a problem at NASA because all the engineers that designed it and knew how it worked had retired. And, you know, so like that knowledge, they took the knowledge of how the shuttle systems functioned with them. And so you could have really, you know, freshly minted energized young people wanting to come in, but they were looking at this stuff saying, okay, why exactly is there bubble gum stuck over here? Is that an is that important? And, you know, the old guys would say, oh, yeah, 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 don't touch that. That rebalances the cranostat, and, you know, we need that.
Yeah.
You know, that was carefully calibrated bubble gum, but, you know, the new guys wouldn't know.
Yeah.
So I got a kick out of some of the reporting of this, talking about undetected cross-rat malware. And I thought, well, okay, not undetectable. The headlines were saying, and this is the, remember the cross-rat is the Trojan, which the dark Caracal is using, written in Java, cross-platform, runs on Windows, Linux, and Mac OS. And some of the coverage said that it was undetectable. No, it is currently undetected, but there's nothing about it which is that is fundamentally undetectable. At the moment, and this is the useful cautionary about this, only 2 out of the 55 AV scanners at VirusTotal are detecting the Dark Caracal's cross-rat Trojan, the remote access Trojan, as malicious, which that is certainly a concern. On the other hand, you know, this all just became public a week ago, and I'm sure that a week or two from now, the detection count will have jumped up to, you know, nearly all of the AV scanners. You know, as we've seen, today's AV uses patterns and heuristics, and there are certainly features in Dark Caracal that is in this cross-rat Trojan that any AV could lock onto. For example, there is a very well-known domain which cross-rat currently uses for its command and control server. All anyone would have to do is scan for the presence of that domain. The problem is that as soon as that was unmasked, it was changed. So what we need is a more mature analysis of CrossRat in order to come up with some signatures that will reliably detect it even when it changes. Now that it's on everybody's map, I'm sure that all of the AV tools will be getting samples of it and will be adding detection of it to their suite. And of course, you know, as our listeners know, the first version of Inspector set off just about every alarm that there was across the AV industry for no reason except that I had used a registry key that was regarded as sensitive. And because it's the one that I use for flipping the protection on and off. And it wasn't that I was using that key for that purpose. It's just that it is a sensitive access key. And so, unfortunately, all I had to do was obscure my use of the key. You know, once I saw that what was happening, I figured out what it was that was probably the problem. And I encrypted the key and then I decrypted on the fly. So this sort of demonstrates that it is, I mean, this is the cat and mouse game that malware and anti-malware go through, is that as soon as a piece of malware is detected, if it's able to determine what it is that it's doing that's setting off the alarms, it can hide itself. And, you know, thus the cat and mouse game that is going on constantly. In this case, there's nothing, you know, there's no real concern about this cross-rat Trojan being undetectable. It's just currently not detected. What I would remind our listeners, the takeaway is that it's written in Java. And I understand that there are valid uses, especially within enterprise, for using Java. Java, the advantage of Java is that it is cross-platform. And there are legitimate uses and applications for Java. But they're not super mainstream. So most users do not need Java installed on their systems. It is not by default installed in systems. So it needs to get added for some reason. So as long as you do not have Java in your Windows, Mac, or Linux machine, then this Java dependent Trojan cannot run on your system. So I would say be aware of whether you have the Java runtime present. If you do and you don't need it, remove it, and be aware of anything that installs it, because you know it itself is not dangerous, but we are seeing instances. I mean, traditionally, when Java was exposed to the browser, that was a source of constant problems. We solved that problem, and Java now, by default, finally, is not available to the browser, thank goodness. Not having it around at all is even better. And if you don't need it, make sure you don't have it, because it can be used for mischief. And then last bit of news, just as I was, as literally like minutes before we began recording the podcast, I got the news that the California Senate had approved a similar action. Actually, this one had more teeth in it than what Montana that was first. And then 2 days later, just recently, the New York State's governor both signed into orders. There is state-level pushback on net neutrality, that is, on what Ajit Pai has done with essentially overturning the existing legislation, as we've covered and has been covered throughout the Twit network recently. What the states are doing is sort of clever. They're using their purse, the power of the purse, or their purchasing power, in order to effectively enforce net neutrality within their states. These governors are signing executive orders, and one is now, we can add California to this list. It's got to go to the state assembly for ratification, but it's virtually assured to pass. Unfortunately, this is ending up being political and partisan. And so what we're seeing as votes are falling down along Republican Democratic party lines, but the assembly in California is something like 58-23 Democrat majority. So given that same party, party line vote occurs on this issue, it's virtually certain to pass in California. So we'll have a number of major states who are saying that no state funded organization or facility can purchase internet services from any provider that does not honor neutral handling of bandwidth, that is net neutrality. So, you know, New York is a massive consumer of internet, and certainly that is New York State services and facilities, and certainly that's the case in California as well. The providers, of course, are now asking for legislation to outlaw this kind of state-level action. So, you know, this is all not done yet. But for now, states are exercising their independent rights, saying, okay, fine, if there's no federal policy to prevent this, then we're not going to allow any purchasing of bandwidth from providers at the state level, and we'll take it from there. And certainly no provider would be willing to give up all of the access to the amount of money that the large states are spending on bandwidth in order to play games with their bandwidth. I didn't know where to put this. I put this under errata only because it was kind of harsh, but I thought, well, it's an opinion I wanted to examine. Someone named Ryan Day tweeted, "I didn't appreciate the flippant nature of your coverage of Intel's Spectre mitigation work," he wrote. He said, "Speculative execution has been a business as usual feature for a long time. No argument there. And there are a lot of people working very, very hard to re-engineer the microcode and change everything on a dime. Your disrespectful remarks on their less than perfect first efforts doesn't help anything and likely insults many young coders who view you as a role model." So that kind of caught me by surprise, but I thought, okay. If there was any confusion, I just wanted to say that, I mean, I understand how difficult this is. And I'm impressed by the idea that microcode can be flexible enough to surface these sorts of features which were not intended and designed in from the beginning. So by no means am I intending to demean, or did I intend to demean, the efforts or to make light of the difficulty that doing this presents. What I expressed my dismay over was Intel's presentation of this. You know, they apparently know exactly what's going on. This is not a security issue any longer, since that we've had full disclosure of exactly what the vulnerabilities are, with demonstrations and proofs of concept of these problems. What annoys me is that we're getting a lot of hand waving from Intel. They're saying, "Oh well, you know, describing this as more reboots than usual." Well, tell us what's going on. Tell us what the problem is. Give us, tell us what you know, Intel. And Intel is not doing that. Again, everyone who listened to this podcast knows how well I understand that anybody can make a mistake. Mistakes get made. What matters is the way you deal with them. And dealing with them is about communication as much as it is about engineering in this day and age. So what I took exception to and still take exception to is the PR spin and the obfuscating that Intel is subjecting us to. They could tell us, apparently they know exactly what is going on. If we had that, I would have no complaint with Intel. So it's not the engineering, it's not the coding, it's not, the work of the people who I'm sure are scrambling around like crazy. It's that we're not having useful communication about something that I would argue is incredibly important. This is incredibly important. As Ryan, you write, speculative execution is business as usual. And I have never faulted Intel for ending up in this place. It is the case that this has gone on for decades, and I have said that I object to the idea of class action suits being filed against any of these companies. I don't see fault in the fact that there are these defects which can be leveraged, and I never have. The fault I find is in Intel's communication. And that's the only complaint that I have.
I wonder if Ryan wrote this tweet before Intel pulled back on all of its fixes because it caused spontaneous rebooting.
Actually, I think not. And based on his location, I think he is at Intel. Okay. They have a facility up in the Pacific Northwest, I think.
Yeah. Which I don't think he insulted where anybody.
He yeah. And Leo? Friday.
See, I like this book. I don't, you know me in science fiction. Televised or filmed.
I know. I wanted to give all of our listeners a heads up. Those who have access to Netflix, that it's probably going to be binge time starting on this Friday, February 2nd, is the release of the first 10 episodes, that is the first season, of Altered Carbon. Altered Carbon is a term sci-fi readers know well. It's a fabulous title for a book, I think written in 2002. It's been a while. It was a cyberpunk novel. And boy, the preview looks wonderful. So just a heads up, again, Altered Carbon is released on Friday. And the good news is, I think you and I both have mates, Leo, who are as into this as we are. So I have no doubt that by this time next week, Lori and I, at least, and I imagine you and Lisa, will have absorbed the first 10 episodes of this very, very interesting looking new series. Yeah. And as I said at the top of the show, probably one of the most fun Spinrite testimonials we've run across in a long time. Of course, it starts off with a subject that got my attention. Spinrite is great. And then continues with, "Hi, Steve, if that is your real name." Cleet Boyce wrote this. He said, "I purchased a copy of Spinrite about 100 years ago, you know, when dinosaurs ruled the earth, and I am amazed at how many times Spinrite has saved the day. I am," he writes, "a hacker penetration tester," so he's probably a listener to the podcast, "penetration tester, software engineer, super genius, who enjoys torturing hard drives on the weekends. I really enjoy doing things like playing around with Linux kernel code. And since I am a super genius, I can feel free to ignore any and all warnings on the various forums. However, every once in a while, I will be exploring the frontiers of ignorance and write some code that seems to completely destroy the hard drive itself. I will make one innocent change to the kernel code, reboot the PC, and all of a sudden, I hear the PC beeping for mercy, see smoke shooting out the back, and see a tear in the space-time continuum forming in the middle of my living room. I check to see what the problem is, and sure enough, my PC can no longer read the hard drive. That's okay, though, since I am a level 14 hacker elf, probably, and a super genius. I know that I can easily fix the problem. I reach into my satchel and pull out my magic Spinrite disk. Oh, and speak of the devil. Pop it into the CD drive and wait while Spinrite does some stuff that is probably very technical. I walk away, praying to the computer gods that they may forgive me, and most of all, hope that Spinrite can fix the problem yet again. I've done these terrible things to poor defenseless hard drives many, many, many times. And every time, Spinrite manages to fix the problem. The best part is I can happily continue to torture poor defenseless hard drives on the weekends without fear of completely destroying them, because I know that Spinrite can apparently fix anything. While it might be true that hyperbole is my best friend, the underlying theme of this testimony is true. Steve, thank you for using your powers for good and not evil, and Spinrite works pretty well too. Cleet Boyce." Well, Cleet, thank you very much for a fun testimonial. And a couple of closing the loop bits of feedback from our listeners. Neil Gardner, he said, "Thank you for Security Now. Learn a lot each week. How does one stop a Win10 machine from updating to Creator Edition?" And, you know, I meant to get the exact language. Maybe you can, Leo, if you have a Win10 machine running in front of you.
Yes.
In the advanced settings, there are two drop-down list boxes containing numbers of days. And the one of them, you're able to ask Windows 10 to defer updating for fixes for some number of days, and the other one allows you to ask it to defer updating feature improvements for some number of days. And in fact, I was just visiting that because I was setting up a new machine. I had to play with this 1703, 1709 question, the creator's update versus the fall creator's update, which is the 1709 newer one. And I noted that it was immediately getting ready. It was like, there it was. It was updating to Windows 10 1709. So I thought, ah! And I quickly went over to the advanced settings and dialed down the feature update to 365 days. It will let you push it back 1 year is the maximum on that little drop down. And that immediately, I was very pleased to see it honored that setting and immediately stopped trying to move me to 1709 because I specifically needed that machine to stay at 1703 because that was the one that had this glitch that I talked about at the top of the podcast where there was a bug in that particular version. So I was able to do that by using those two settings. And what exactly is the
I'm not finding the place you're pointing to. So
So it was under updates in Win 10, and then there's like advanced settings, which takes you to another level, and there's two different things you can change.
Yeah, neither of these seem to have. Remember, this may depend on the version of Windows you're using and so forth. And you may have other limits on what you can.
I realize that I do have one in front of me. Maybe I can bring it up here.
Monthly upload. I don't know.
Update
exactly.
And security.
Is it in the main control panel?
So Windows Update, Advanced Options under Windows Update.
Yeah.
And Delivery Optimization, is that where it was?
Yeah, it's not there.
No, that's you're right. I'm not seeing that. I wonder if they took that away.
Microsoft giveth and Microsoft taketh away.
How interesting, because I have it in 1703. Yeah. And you're right, I'm not. Delivery optimization is not it. That's the thing for getting it from, your neighborhood or others. Weird.
I'm in the advanced system properties. Performance, user profiles, startup and recovery.
How funny! I did. I sure saw that and dialed it down, and it stopped bothering me.
It's under advanced.
So. Gee, Neil, we'll have the detailed answer for you next week. Or I'm sure, get help with your updates? No. Update. How weird.
So is it in, tell me, Burke, where is
so
it?
Mine is if you go to
back here, right?
That one looks different than mine.
See, that's the problem. I think that, well, now you already have the Fall Creators
right
update.
There on the right, if you go down
Advanced there. Options.
Hey, you know, Leo, maybe if you're up to date, it doesn't give them to you because I'm on 1709 on the machine.
It.
I'm looking.
We're up to so date
if,
now.
If there is something to defer, then it lets you defer. If there's nothing to be deferred, then maybe it just doesn't give you the option. So we'll go with that.
Yeah, because I'm not seeing it. This is one for we'll ask Paul and Mary Jo. Yeah, see, it's not. Burke keeps saying, no, it's there, but it's not.
And I think maybe it's only there for people who have something to be deferred.
Yeah.
And in this case, on the machine, I just was checking on the machine I'm using because I'm talking to you through a Win 10 machine, and I'm not seeing it, but I certainly was on the 1703 machine.
Now, somebody on 1709 build 16 says it does have the option.
Oh.
So who even freaking knows?
Anyway. Neil, it's there somewhere. So sorry you couldn't be more precise.
You know, I had this problem on the radio show, and I felt like an idiot because I couldn't find the setting. The problem is Microsoft seems to change stuff randomly from update to update. And so it really depends not even just what version of Windows you're running, but really what update you have.
Or what mood they were in that day.
It's very, very confusing. So
Neil is there somewhere, maybe. And maybe we'll get – I'm sure the good news is this podcast is heard by so many people who know the answer. Leo and I will both be flooded with the answer, and we will have a definitive response.
Yeah, so this is interesting because Burke's showing me his screen, which does have this, exactly where mine doesn't. So I don't – you got
that
me.
That is bizarre. That is so disturbing.
Imagine how dumb I felt during the radio show, fumbling around with this, saying, well, I used to be here. Where is it? What is it?
Yeah, well, add me to that club, Leo, because I just stuck my foot in it, too.
Well, I don't know. Okay.
Well, I am
up to
answer.
Date. Maybe that has something to do with it. I don't know.
Yeah, but Burke must be, too, right?
Who knows what Burke's doing?
Okay.
May have something to do with a version of the operating system. This is Windows Pro, I'm pretty sure. So
yeah, mine was too.
Yeah,
and I'm sure this one is.
Yeah.
Oh, wait, this might be home because this one came with this little machine.
Yeah.
It was already pre-installed.
Yeah. I'm running. Let me see real quickly. Windows. Oh, I'm on home too. You know what? That's probably what it is. It's probably, you would think this Lenovo T470S would be Windows Pro, but maybe I realized I didn't need it. So maybe that's what it is. Maybe you might have to.
Yep. And I haven't wanted to mess with this because this is working perfectly for the podcast.
Yeah.
And what is it?
So that's an issue, by the way, because.
Yep. It's Windows 10 Home, Leo, the one that doesn't have it.
It's unpredictable what version you'll have. Now, you could go into GP Edit. You can download the. Well, I guess you can. I don't know. You can download General Policy Editor and change this.
Microsoft's
said if you accepted the 7 to 10 upgrade, you can only defer for so long. A year seems long enough, but.
Yeah. I was happy to see it let me set it to 365. It wasn't clear that the thing scrolled down into the basement because it came up and it said like 1 to 7 or something. I thought, really? But then I'd like set it to 7. Then I opened it again. Now it went from 7 to 14. I said, oh. So I just kept, I went all the way to the bottom and it was 365. Yeah. And we know where they got that number. Okay, so that answers the mystery. It's home does not let you defer.
I'm not going to pay the $100 to upgrade to Pro to find out either. But
good luck, and Pro does. Yep.
Yeah.
So Neil, that's your answer. If you've got Pro, you can do it, but maybe you don't, and so that would explain.
Yeah, I think home doesn't. That's one of the probably the biggest difference is you can't defer.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. So that's anyway. I had a comment, but I'm just going to bite my tongue because we know how I feel.
Yes.
So I got a person whose name I didn't capture on Twitter asked, will Inspector, my little freeware, work on Macs if run in a Windows VM? And that's significant because a VM is different than Wine. And I wanted to highlight that for our listeners. Wine is a sort of a thin Windows emulation layer. So Inspector will run under Wine and be able to show you the truth about the processor, that is the firmware. The problem with a Windows VM, if you mean a full virtual machine, is that it is virtualizing the chip, which means that it's a function of what the VM's chip virtualization is choosing to show its hosted OS, and that's not clear. So Inspector will work in as much as it will run, but you will not be able to. I can't guarantee you, depending upon what the virtual machine is doing, that it will. I mean, it will not. If it's a true virtual machine, it will not be seeing the actual chip. The VM could be showing its client systems, its hosted OS, the same as what is on the chip or not, depending. So you really wouldn't know for sure. But the good news is Wine is pretty easy to run now on a Mac. So you're able to host the Inspector on Wine, and then, yes, you'll be able to see what's really going on. my comments about battery charging stirred up a lot of debate and question, as they always do. And I'm going to share two tweets and then try to clarify. Richard Bailey said, he wrote at SGGRC about battery health. The AccuBattery app recommends only charging your phone to 80% to also preserve its longevity. It gives me a tone when it gets to the percent I set, and I have to disconnect it from the charger. Ofer Bannery wrote, RE babying batteries. What about overcharging? I've been unplugging the device within 10 seconds of 100%. Is this no longer necessary? Okay, so to everyone, it is absolutely the case that it's the endpoints, the fully discharged, the fully charged, that are problematical. That's why I referred to being so impressed with my Lenovo laptop that noted after a few weeks that it was always plugged in and said, hey, how about if I run this down to 50% and hold it there? That's absolutely ideal, though it does, as I said, require me to plan if I'm going to be running on battery and want to for a long time to run her back up to 100 or near 100 before leaving the house. So to Richard, who has an app that gives him a chime when it hits 80, yes, that would be better than running all the way up to 100. Also, if you have a battery management system which isn't good about keeping the battery from being overcharged, well, then that's a problem. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that this is inherently a trade-off. If you don't go to 100%, that's better for your battery. But obviously, then you have less available when you're out running around and you don't want to go too low because that's bad too. So if you're a person who for whom it is worth giving a lot of your attention to keeping your battery between, for example, the 80% and the 30% high and low point, then great. That's going to be better for the battery, requiring more of your attention. If you don't want to invest that much, for me, I've sort of reached a compromise. I assume that Apple, the builder of my iOS devices, and I'm sure that, well, I was going to say that Samsung knows how not to overcharge, except they're rather famous for having a problem with some of their batteries. For me, it's a compromise. I'm going to leave my devices plugged in when I'm not using them, and I'm not going to discharge them much because of my own life habits. When they're off of the charger, they never have a chance to go down much below, 70%, and then they get plugged in again. Consequently, I've never had a battery life noticeably shortened. On the other hand, I'm not using them very much. They're mostly, tethered to power. So I hope that clarifies it. It is really bad to run them to the bottom. They really don't like that. It's better not to run them all the way to the top. If your device allows you to run them to 80% or 90%, that's probably better than running them to 100%. It's dangerous to overcharge them. So if you keep them away from the danger zone, that's better, but at the cost of them having them not having as much runaround time when they're off of the wall. But so that's, I think, the best way to sum this all up is don't let them run down too low. Try not to cycle them through extremes often. If your device lets you not charge them all the way up, take advantage of that. If you want to take responsibility, great. And I think everyone probably falls somewhere within that spectrum. And lastly, Peter Kirby noted from our picture of the week last week. You remember, Leo, that was the one that was we had fun with, where the sort of the philosophical approach to entering your password was, ooh, you're close. You're only off by one character. And we made fun of it, saying, yes, it's very clear why that's not the proper wisdom for dealing with a password. Anyway, Peter noted that he says, I was showing someone the pick of the week from 647, and it occurred to me, if the back end knows you're only one character off, then they aren't hashing the password like they should be, or they wouldn't be able to know that. And actually, that's a very good point, Peter. So I just got a kick out of that observation. Yes, not only are they doing the wrong thing philosophically, but the fact that they're able to do that philosophically means they are also really not doing the right thing technically, because they're able to compare the password you gave them versus the one you're in the clear password and go, oh, cool, he was really close. Let's let him know. He's got, you know, try changing the punctuation a little bit and maybe you'll get there. So anyway, great feedback from our listeners. Thank you. And that's our podcast, 648.
Nice.
For the week.
Well done. A job well done. We can put this one in the bank. You can get it now as soon as we finish editing it and chopping it up at Steve's
massaging
site.
It a little
massage.
Bit. Oh,
minor.
I did want to mention to anyone who looks for these transcripts, Elaine's schedule is a little bit impacted this week and next week.
Okay.
So she begged me. She said, Steve, would it be a problem if I'm a few days late? And I said, our listeners love you. They love having the transcripts. A little bit late is not a problem.
No.
So
yeah.
I'll put up a notice to that effect for people who don't hear this. But this week and next, the good news is she's busy. And she said, you know, it would really help me if you would let me, you know, put you off a little bit so I can get another project finished. And I said, absolutely. You know, she's been so wonderful for 12 plus years. I have no problem with that.
Oh, absolutely. And I think, yeah, the transcript's really as much for archival purposes and searching purposes. Although I know some of you like to read while you listen, but you'll just have to defer a little bit longer. You can get the transcripts and the audio versions at grc.com. While you're there, check out SpinRite, the world's best hard drive recovery and maintenance utility, even today, even for SSDs.
Even if you're an evil super genius,
even if you
need it then.
Especially if you're an evil super genius. You'll also find lots of free stuff. Steve's very generous, and including Inspector to inspect the status of your device. Now, I forgot to get this in while you were talking about it. Wine recently updated to Wine 3, and for some reason, the latest version of Inspector and Wine 3 on my Mac do not like each other. So Wine hangs. And don't know what it means. I'll try it on some other Macs for what it's worth.
Interesting. I will end up addressing that because we've been taking pains to get Squirrel working under Wine, so it would be available under Linux. And apparently, it's now running under Android on Wine for Android. So that's good. So I'll have to figure out what's going on, and
Wine had a big update with Wine 3 this week.
Wine 3.
That I was using it under Wine, an earlier version of Wine before.
Yep.
Anyway, get Inspector if you have a PC especially. I think people on Macs if you're running High Sierra, you probably just can relax. It's the older operating systems on the Mac that you got to worry a little bit about because Apple's been slow to get those fixed. Let's see. What else? We have the show as well on our website, twit.tv/SN for Security Now. Video as well if you'd like to see Steve gesticulate. He's a fine gesticulator. Yes. twit.tv/SN. You can also find subscription links there or just look in your favorite podcast application and subscribe. That way you'll get every episode as soon as it comes out. We only keep, you know, the way a podcast works, it's an RSS feed, and we only keep the 10 most recent episodes in there. If we had all 648, the RSS feed would be hundreds and hundreds of megabytes, which would kill your bandwidth, kill our bandwidth. It'd be terrible. You'd be downloading that five times a day. No, you don't want to do that. So just the last 10 episodes. However, you can go to the website and get all 648 there, twit.tv/snorgrc.com. We invite you to take the Twit survey. We do this every year, beginning of the year, just try to get a better handle on who's listening. There are a lot of new listeners to Security Now, so it would be very helpful if you go to twit.tv/survey. We are not collecting in any way. We're not collecting your email. We're not collecting personal information. This is to be used in aggregate. Two different groups. One is us, because we'd like to know more about how you listen and what you listen to. And the other is advertisers, because we don't collect information in any other way about you. This is the one time a year we get to know a little bit more about our audience. And advertisers would like to know that. We don't give them any information about you personally, I promise. And even the in aggregate is really general broad strokes. It makes them feel better. twit.tv/survey if you would like to help us out. If you want to visit the studio, you can. No surprises, though. Let us know ahead of time. Tickets at twit.tv. Just as you prize your security online, we prize our physical security here in the studio. So email us first. tickets@twit.tv. Thanks for being here. Thank you, Steve. Enjoy Altered Carbon. We'll compare notes.
Oh, yes.
Next week.
Yay.
Security Now. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Security Now.